We come in our studies in Genesis this evening to this rather remarkable chapter which describes the expedition of Abraham against King Chedorlaomer. But before we look at this chapter, it has occurred to me that it would be useful for me to say a word once again, although we have mentioned this previously in our studies, that would relate these studies in Genesis to the Christian gospel in the New Testament. We are, after all, reading about some very ancient happenings. And, of course, the name of Christ does not appear in the book of Genesis or in the Old Testament. But I think it is important that we should recognize that in taking the book of Genesis as our subject matter, we are necessarily interpreting it from a Christological point of view. That is to say, we are determinedly relating it to the gospel of the New Testament. And I would like it to be understood that this is always what we have in view in this study. We are not, repeat, not studying the book of Genesis as an exercise in antiquarian interest, although there's a great deal of antiquarian interest of great fascination in the book of Genesis. But that's not what we are about. We have, you will recall, made mention of the apostle's famous words in the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 11, the great faith chapter, as we sometimes call it, which reiterates the words, by faith Noah, by faith Abraham, by faith Moses, by faith David. That is to say, the Old Testament story is being specifically related to New Testament categories. And I want it to be understood that every Sunday evening, whichever part of Genesis we may be in, this is the underlying presupposition in our study. And you will remember, won't you, that the Lord Jesus himself said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad. Now, many constructions can be placed upon these marvelous words from the lips of Jesus, and doubtless all of them legitimate, but they do bear witness to this fact that I am seeking to underline, that when we are studying the story of Abraham, we're not studying something different or disparate from the message of the gospel. And this is why we can extrapolate from the book of Genesis into the New Testament without any sense of incongruity. And what is more, we can interpret the life and the pilgrimage and the experience of Abraham in New Testament terms without doing any kind of violation to true exposition or true exegesis of any particular passage. Now, it struck me coming down this evening that it might be useful for us to be reminded of that once again, and no doubt I will be reminding you of it in later studies also. But that being said, we're going to look at this story now in that kind of light. There was a time when Old Testament scholars dismissed this chapter as being purely legendary and of no historical validity at all. This was a tiresome habit that Old Testament scholars got into some years ago. Some of them haven't got out of it yet, but many of them have. But then the archaeologists began to discover things in the ancient Near East. And in fact, there are tablets in the British Museum at the present day with the names of some of these kings inscribed on them. And no reputable scholar would hazard the opinion that this is legendary material. This has been authenticated historically by the findings of archaeology. And this happened. It's a very interesting, a very fascinating story. It's a story that could have been repeated many times in the ancient world. Smaller kingdoms were always entering into leagues with one another against the latest oppressor from the northeast. And some of the great ancient empires that swept down upon Palestine made easy prey of these nations and laid them under tribute. And this obviously is what happened here. 12 years these petty kingdoms around the shores of the Dead Sea suffered the domination of this King Chedorlaomer. And we're told that in the 13th year, they rebelled. And the following year, Chedorlaomer came and stormed down and made a destruction of them. And they took, verse 11, all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Now, notice, first of all, the time scale here. We are 13 or 14 years on from last Sunday's study, when we read of the parting of the ways for Abram and Lot. And Lot, who had his eye on the main chance, cast his eyes upon the fertile plains of Jordan, the north of the Dead Sea, and said, "That's where I want to be." And he chose that. And Abraham allowed him his choice. We saw the fateful note in last week's chapter. Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. 13 years on, and Lot, we're told in verse 12, now dwelt in Sodom. And we're told in last week's chapter that Sodom was an exceeding wicked place. And maybe Lot had no original intention of becoming involved in Sodom. But when you pitch your tent towards Sodom, you put yourself within the radius of its evil influence, and you get sucked in. And that is what happened to Lot. And he learned the hard way that the way of the transgressor is hard. Now, he was righteous, Lot. He was a godly man. But he had got out of touch with God and had become a plain backslider. And he entered into Sodom and suffered. Now, I don't wish to spend time with Lot this evening. We will come back to him later on. But what we need to recognize is this, that when Abraham went to his rescue and brought him back, Lot, having been rescued, went back into Sodom again. Now, what does that say about this man's blindness and insensitiveness to the voice of God? Do you not think that in what happened to him, this frightening, indeed terrifying abduction by Chedorlaomer, this powerful king from the northeast, do you not think that in that terrifying experience, the voice of God was not speaking to him in warning tones? Could he not have heard God when God was speaking so loud and clear to him? Maybe he did. Maybe he was praying for all he was worth on the north road, crying to God for help. And maybe he was very grateful to Abraham when Abraham and his confederates rescued him and slew the powerful king Chedorlaomer. Although there's no evidence in the record that he even said thank you to Abraham for rescuing him. But what is clear from the record is that he went back to Sodom again. So that whether or not he was crying to God in prayer as a terrified man might cry when he was taken captive, the lure of Sodom exercised itself again upon the man. And back he went. And the next time, and a few chapters on, he was taken by the scruff of the neck by the angels of God out of Sodom before God rained fire and brimstone upon it for its sin. But we'll come to Lot later on in the story. We're concerned with Abraham. And we're told that when news came from someone who escaped and told him that Lot had been taken in that terrible attack on Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham organized a rescue mission. He armed his trained servants and allied himself with colleagues, the brother of Eshcol and the brother of Anna, and together they headed northwards in pursuit. Now, we need not spend time on the details of the battle, but the battle was won, and the fortunes of the captives were quickly reversed, and we're told that Abram brought back all the goods and also brought again his brother Lot and his goods and the women also and the people. Now, it says something, doesn't it? For the generosity of Abraham's character, that there was no spirit of serves him right for going to live in Sodom about Abraham. Nothing but a generous and concerned spirit. The ties of blood and family set to one side the shabby treatment that Lot had given Abraham in chapter 13. And all his concern was to retrieve the situation. And this he did. Now, I think the thing that we are meant to gather from this story is, first of all, the bigness of Abram's character in what he did, and the generous spirit in which he pursued Chedorlaomer. It was a hazardous operation. He might have been killed. And it would have been understandable if Abraham had felt that he wasn't in a position to do this and wasn't able to do this, let alone not willing, because of the hazardous nature of the whole matter. But nothing like that moved him. Off he went. And God gave him the victory. That's the first thing that we need to recognize. And it's the character of the man that emerges. And here's something else. We've been looking at Abraham in terms of a pilgrim and stranger. And so he was. He confessed that he was a pilgrim and stranger upon the earth. And he looked for a city with foundations whose builder and maker was God. But that doesn't mean, and it didn't mean in Abraham's case, that he was a spineless creature. And here we see Abraham, the warrior of God, the intrepid, fearless, courageous warrior, carrying war into the enemy's territory. And acquitting himself with distinction. And this is, one might say, an almost unlooked for characteristic about the man of God. Now, I have only to mention to you the kind of presentation that the media give of the man of God today. One does not have to elaborate on this. But words like spineless, flabby, too good to be true, wishy-washy, helpless creatures readily come to mind. But here was a man, intrepid, bold, and it makes us wonder whether, in fact, this is the same man as we saw in chapter 12, telling half-truths down in Egypt to King Pharaoh to save his precious skin, careless of what it might have meant to Sarah, his wife. Say you're my sister, and then I'll be safe. And that was the Abraham we saw. Here's the real man. Here's the man in whom God is at work. And my dear friends, this is something that we have to recognize. When God the Lord begins to work in a man's life, one of the things that he imparts to that life is integrity and character and strength and vigor and courage. And I'm glad that this story is in the sacred scriptures, because it shows just what can happen to a man. A man who, naturally speaking, might be very timid, as Abraham was in the Egypt episode, and fearful. But God can take a life like that and make it big. And what comes through here is the picture of a big man. And just how big, we see as we continue to study it. We're told in verse 17 that the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is in the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed Abraham and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God who hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand." And Abraham gave him tithes of all. And the king of Sodom said to Abraham, "Give me the persons and take the goods, take the booty to yourself." And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God. I have vowed to him that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldst say, I have made Abraham rich." Now, do you see the picture that's emerging here? There are two episodes, one with Melchizedek, the one with the king of Sodom. Let's take the king of Sodom's episode first. Take the booty. This was the done thing. This was the accepted thing. And the king of Sodom was very grateful and recognized the debt in which he stood to Abraham for this remarkable victory. Take the spoils. And Abraham said, And he wouldn't take a thing. Why? Oh, there are a number of reasons. For one thing, Abraham had seen over these 12 or 13 years doing to his nephew. And he said, "I want nothing to do with it. I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole." You see, he's clear-sighted. He sees the issues. And he is not going to be involved in any way in complicity with this depraved king and his possessions. That's one reason. But there's something else. He said, "I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord. I have made a vow." to the Lord, the Most High God, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet. Now, what does this say to us? What does this imply? What does this indicate? I'll tell you what it indicates. It indicates that this matter was settled in Abraham's mind and heart before ever he started off in pursuit of Chedorlaomer. Lines of conduct for this man were settled before the action took place, and therefore nothing could shift him. Now, doesn't that say a great deal about the character of this man? Here is a man who had got life so sorted out that he knew in advance what he would do and what he wouldn't do, what he could do and what he couldn't do. And therefore, there were no problems for him. There was no temptation for him to take the spoils. Now that's a great way to live. That's the life of faith. And if we are going on with the Lord, this is one of the things that the Lord will develop in our life and experience. Lots of believers often have difficulty in matters of guidance in their lives. Big things, small things, critical things, everyday matters. And they're often perplexed. And of course, we spend a lot of time trying to give counsel and guidance to believers. But the question that does arise is whether there ought to be so many problems as that. And the question arises whether there would be problems of that nature if God had been allowed to build into our life and experience lines of conduct that we recognized as being inviolable. And from which nothing could shift us when we're presented with a sudden situation. What are the problems that vex Christians today? The problems that vex many young Christians is the boy and girl relationship. Well now, relate that kind of situation to the lines of conduct that I'm speaking about. Because, you see, there are plain lines of conduct laid down for us in Holy Writ that none of us need to be in any doubt about. And if these lines of conduct are fixed as inviolables in our experience, then when emotional involvement knocks at our door, we will not be moved. And we will know that certain relationships are just not on. It is not good for the man to be alone, we read in chapter 2. I will make an helpmeet for him. Great. But on the simplest interpretation of these words, help. Help, not hindrance. Meet, suitable, not unsuitable. And along comes an emotional involvement. And the person on offer is certainly not going to be a help, but a down drag for spiritual life. Is certainly not suitable, but manifestly unsuitable. Where's the problem? I'll tell you where the problem is. The problem lies in undisciplined emotions that have never submitted themselves to the divine lines of conduct. And that's why many lives get in a snarl. That's why. Abraham had it all sorted out before this campaign started. I have vowed to the Lord, the Most High God, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet. And he didn't. Now that's faith. That's faith in action. That's faith in operation. And there's a lot to be said for the fine young Christian girl who, when she was teased about not having a partner, said, "The desirable is not attainable, and the attainable is not desirable." Good for her. That's what I mean. That's character. That's character. Forgive me focusing on that. It just came into my mind. But it is surely a very wide application. And do not let us forget that the last verse of the previous chapter, where God said to the man, "Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee." Then Abraham removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar to the Lord. His life was sanctified by his dedication to the Lord. And it was the influence of that altar in Mamre that was with him throughout that whole campaign against Chedorlaomer, and that made him stand 10 feet tall before the inducement of this depraved king of Sodom when he offered him the glittering booty, and he would have none of it. That's faith. Is that what your faith in Christ is doing to you? Is it producing the lineaments of character and integrity in your life? Look at the other encounter. In verse 18 we're told, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him. Now, this is an extremely mysterious episode, and it is full of all sorts of spiritually suggestive ideas. He brought forth bread and wine, the staple food of the time, yes. But it is not difficult, is it, to think that in some mysterious way this was somehow a sacramental occasion in which this priest of the Most High God blessed Abraham. The word Melchizedek is a combination of two Hebrew words, and it literally means king of righteousness. Melech is the Hebrew word for king. Tzaddik is righteous. King of righteousness. King of Salem. King of peace. This was his title. And you will probably know that this mysterious figure is taken up both by the psalmist and by the apostle in the epistle to the Hebrews and used to considerable effect in relation to the Lord Jesus Christ. The point that the Hebrew epistle makes about Melchizedek, and you can read about it in chapter 7 of the epistle to the Hebrews, and it will repay careful study. The point that the apostle is making is this, that this Melchizedek had neither beginning of days nor end of life. Now, all that that means is that in the scripture record, there is no mention of where he came from, what his genealogy was. He just suddenly appears, and as suddenly disappears. But significantly, he appears as the emissary of the Most High God. And it is an extremely significant thing that at this particular juncture, when Abraham returned victorious from that campaign against Chedorlaomer, God sent his man to meet with him and to lay hands upon him and to bless him in this mysterious encounter. Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God who hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And Abraham gave him tithes of all that he possessed. Now, why on earth should he have done that? If not that he recognized that in this encounter, he was meeting the representative of God, and God was meeting with him. Now, it's an extraordinary thing that in this situation and at this juncture, God should have had his man, his priest, to speak to Abraham from God. And I think the secret here lies just in this, that this Melchizedek, king of righteousness and king of peace, had intimations from God, as centuries later Balaam, the prophet from Baal Peor, a man out with the covenant, was the mouthpiece of the living God, pronouncing blessing upon Israel, Abraham's progeny. And here Melchizedek pronounces upon Abraham. And it seems to me that what he was saying was this: Abraham, there is a future for you, bright with promise, beyond all your imaginings. And the way that God has led you thus far, and the response you have made thus far in building an altar to Him, worshipping Him, walking with Him, obeying Him, is to come up for a remembrance before God. And there is a future for you in the divine purposes, bright beyond all that you could realize. And it seems to me that what was happening here was God confirming His promises already given to Abraham. Do you remember what was said at the end of the last chapter? The Lord said unto Abraham, after Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward, eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Well, Abraham's been right through the length of it, up to Dan in the far north, west of Damascus. And now this mysterious figure from nowhere comes to him and says, Abraham, what God said, He really meant, you know. And the future for you is bright with promise. It's not surprising that Abraham said what he did to the king of Sodom. You're offering me the spoils of war, when the Most High God is offering me a future? What do you take me for? He said to the king of Sodom. I've already sorted that out in my mind and in my heart. I vowed to God I would take nothing. And God so wonderfully honored that vow and blessed him. Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, and blessed be the Most High God who will deliver thine enemies into thy hand. So once more God met with this man and assured him that the way he was going was the right way. As if to say, it's all right, Abraham, I'm with you. Nothing is going to come over you. Trust me. Walk with me. And I will be thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. We sometimes sing in that lovely hymn, Lead Kindly Light. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me. There was a lot that Abraham didn't see and didn't know. But he saw enough. My word, he did. Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it. And was glad. Now, what about you? You name the name of Christ? Or do you? Maybe you haven't as yet committed yourself to the life of pilgrimage. Well, Abraham, when he was called to go out to a land which he should afterwards inherit, obeyed. And he went out not knowing whither he went. It may be that the one right thing for you to do is to commit yourself to Christ in the obedience of faith and enter into his salvation and begin to walk on a way that God has appointed for you from before all worlds. But maybe you're stagnating. Maybe you got stuck in your pilgrimage. Could I hazard a guess why? What have you been up to? Has there been a bit of the lot in you? Have you pitched your tent towards Sodom? Have you got your eye on the main chance? Are you compromising your Christian position through complicity with the world? Remember what the Apostle James says, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Is that what's held you up? Look at this man. Look at what God is doing in him. Look at the character, the integrity, the sense of purpose and direction that are emerging as God molds his life. And oh, take heart and say, that's what I want. Here, Lord, take me and make me what thou wilt. We sang, who is on the Lord's side? Well, it's as clear and plain as that. You can't be on both sides. You have to take sides. And there are some lines of conduct that have to be settled once and for all. Have you got them settled? These are the questions that this chapter asks us about our Christian lives. May God give us grace to answer them.